dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week, I'm going to continue with the reading from Charles Eisenstein's The Ascent of Humanity, a wide-ranging tour de force that examines the ideology that underlies the pathological behavior that has caused the human species to bring a planet that was indeed the Garden of Eden to the brink of destruction. This is, for me, a matter of great personal concern as well, as the gas drilling industry is salivating to fasten its jaws on the beautiful place where I live and turn it into a moribund toxic wasteland, as they have already done to the wonderful and beloved home places of others, and in the service of what? That project of the reduction and domination of the natural world gone awry, so that the would-be masters of the universe can cling to it like the railing of a sinking ship. Last week, there was a conference call and a hearing pertaining to discussion of new legislation sponsored by Congressman Maurice Hinchey of New York, who represents many communities in the Finger Lakes, Catskills, and Southern Tier threatened by gas drilling, and co-sponsored by Congresswoman Diana DeGette of Colorado, which has already been horrifically contaminated by drilling for shale gas, as you've heard on previous programs. The Bush-Cheney administration pushed through the enabling legislation in 2005 as part of the energy bill that exempted a process called hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, patented by Halliburton, from provisions of the Clean Air and Clean Water Act and other environmental protection legislation. Treating this process, which is essential to drilling for this gas, as the toxic and destructive process it is, will make it uneconomic, industry proponents argue. And that's good. How many more places are going to be destroyed so agribusiness can continue to produce its toxic food to sell at its plastic-wrapped emporia? It is so amazing that these people are willing to do anything but change. Charles Eisenstein repeatedly compares this behavior of so-called modern civilization to that of the addict, and it seems so apt. Hinchey and DeGette are seeking to repeal this license to pollute and need to hear from their constituents and others to tell them that they are to fight and give no quarter to this powerful industry. And your congresspeople need to hear from you that you want them to support the efforts of Hinchey and DeGette. Unfortunately, I was not able to hear or tape the conference call or the hearing, but I will see what I can find to keep you informed on future programs. Meanwhile, you can get information on this and how to get involved, as well as numbers for local congresspeople at shaleshock.org. That's shaleshock.org. Now I'll continue with the beginning of Chapter 3 of The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and the Convergence of Crises that is Birthing the Transition, the 2006 book by philosopher, mathematician, healer, and linguist Charles Eisenstein. Chapter 3, The Way of the World. The Scientific Method. Starting around the 16th century, our ascent to a separate human realm underwent dramatic acceleration. Language, technology, number, image, and time each became the object of an ambition of Babelian audacity to extend their domains to encompass the whole of reality. Although hints of this program can be found in ancient times, in Greek and biblical urges to exert dominion over the world, it was only with the scientific revolution that we began to envision a plausible means to actually achieve it. 4 centuries later, we see a world utterly transformed. Miracles and magic, the province of the gods, now operate on a daily basis. Instantaneous communication across continents, travel through the air, entire books at the press of a button, perfect moving images, and much more are now commonplace, thanks to science. It is to science that we owe civilization's ascent. It is science, we believe, that has lifted us above primitive superstition to obtain verifiable objective knowledge. Science, the crowning achievement of modern man. Science, unlocking the deepest secrets of the universe. Science, destined to bring the whole of the universe into the human realm of understanding and control. The very adjective scientific implies deep suppositions about the nature of reality and our relationship to reality. Science offers prescriptions on how to live life and how to organize society, how to understand the world and how to pursue knowledge. It tells us who we are, how we came to be, where we are going. Speaking of another culture, we might describe these prescriptions and these stories about the way of the world as a religion. For ourselves, we call them truth, fact, science, fundamentally different from other cultures' myths. But why? Our culture is not alone in believing its myths and stories to be special. We think that ours are true for real, while other cultures merely believed theirs to be true. What are our justifications? 2 stand out, 1 theoretical and 1 practical. The doctrine of objectivity and the power of technology. On the practical level, we believe in the validity of our science because of the great and demonstrable power it has given us through technology to manipulate the material environment. The world of our experience, an artificial world, a human world, is science materialized. The very existence of the world we live in is proof of the validity of science. The god science has given us the ability to reshape the very landscape, alter the code of life, and enact the magic and miracles enumerated above. Having given us such tangible power, how could it be a false god? Yet it's not hard to imagine other cultures that would dismiss our power over the physical environment as inconsequential, an unimportant aspect of life, or that would even deny that our power is really so great. Do we not eat, sleep, pass, waste, make love, grow old, sick, and die, as all other human beings? Do we not experience the same gamut of emotions as human beings everywhere and everywhen? Henry Miller said, quote, "We devise astounding means of communication, but do we communicate with one another? We move our bodies to and fro at incredible speeds, but do we really leave the spot we started from? Mentally, morally, and spiritually, we are fettered. What have we achieved in mowing down mountain ranges, harnessing the energy of mighty rivers, or moving whole populations about like chess pieces, if we ourselves remain the same restless, miserable, frustrated creatures we were before? To call such activity progress is utter delusion. We may succeed in altering the face of the earth until it is unrecognizable even to the Creator, but if we are unaffected, wherein lies the meaning?" Close quote. Yes, we can move mountains and build skyscrapers and talk with people on the other side of the world, but perhaps the importance we place on these things as demonstrations of the truth of our science, of our stories, says more about our values and emphasis than it does about their ultimate validity. In other words, we have a highly developed science of certain aspects of the material world, and we cite our power over exactly those aspects of the material world as proof of the validity of our science. The logic is circular. Another culture might have a highly developed science of aspects of the world that we do not even recognize or that we consider unimportant. An Australian Aborigine might consider us hopelessly primitive in our understanding and use of dreams. A traditional Chinese doctor might find us laughably ignorant of the energetics of plants and the human body. This leads us to the second justification for the belief system we call science. We accord a privileged status to our stories because we think that the scientific method ensures objectivity. Ours is more than a mere religion, we think, because unlike all before it, it rests on verifiable, objective truth. Science is not just another alternative. It encompasses and supersedes all other approaches to knowledge. We can examine dreams or Chinese medicine scientifically. We can perform measurements. We can run double-blind studies. We can test the claims of these other systems of knowledge under controlled conditions. The scientific method, we believe, has eliminated cultural bias in prescribing an impartial, reliable way to derive truth from observation. As physicist Jose Wudka put it, "The scientific method is the best way yet discovered for winnowing the truth from the lies and delusion." This belief is essential to the ideology of science, that it has escaped the bounds of culture and by insisting on replicability and logic, freed knowledge from the yoke of subjectivity. The scientific method, through its testing of hypotheses, invites a kind of certainty absent from other approaches to knowledge, a universal validity that is not culture-bound. Anyone from any culture can perform the same experiment and get identical results. As long as we abide rigorously by the scientific method, we have a reliable way to distinguish fact from superstition, an intellectual razor that cuts through layers of cultural belief to get at the objective truth underneath. Finally, we are free from the bonds of subjectivity, the personal and cultural limits to understanding. But are we? Or could it be that the scientific method is not a supracultural royal road to truth, but itself embodies our own cultural presuppositions about the universe? Could it be that science itself is a vast elaboration of our society's more general beliefs about the nature of reality? Could it be that the entire edifice of science merely projects our culture onto the universe, a projection which we then validate and reinforce through selective observation and facile interpretation? Could it be, in other words, that we too have constructed a myth? Perhaps we've simply done as all other cultures have done. Those observations that fit into our basic mythology we accept as fact. Those interpretations that fit into our conception of self and world, we accept as candidates for scientific legitimacy. Those that do not fit, we hardly bother to consider to verify, prove, or disprove, dismissing them as absurdities unworthy even of consideration. It isn't true because it couldn't be true. It was in that spirit that Galileo's scholarly contemporaries refused to look through his telescope because they knew Jupiter couldn't have moons. History has shown that scientists are no less subject than anyone else to peer pressure, self-deception, institutional blindness, and tunnel vision. Our culture is not alone in believing itself to possess the truth, nor is it alone in the certainty of its belief. However, the problem goes much deeper than the abuse and manipulation of the scientific method. More significant are the method's inherent limitations, which spring from hidden assumptions woven so seamlessly into our worldview that we rarely question them. Indeed, we rarely notice them at all. They imbue our common sense about how to live life and how to organize society, how to understand the world and how to pursue knowledge. Yes, the scientific method can be twisted to serve cultural or institutional biases. What is less obvious is that the scientific method itself represents a very deep and subtle presumption about the nature of reality. Rather than freeing us from cultural prejudice, it draws us in even deeper. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about? The scientific reader might think I'm babbling. What presumptions could there be when the scientific method says, in effect, we will accept nothing on faith, we will test every hypothesis to see whether it is really true? Here is a central assumption of the scientific method that may seem so obvious as to go beyond dispute. If two people perform an identical experiment, they will get the same results. This requires, one, determinism, that the same initial conditions will result in the same final conditions, and two, objectivity, that the experimenter can be separated out from the experiment. These two assumptions are intertwined. If we include the experimenter as part of the initial conditions, then they are never really identical, not even if the experimenter is the same person performing it at a different point in space and time. At bottom, the scientific method assumes that there is an objective universe out there that we can query experimentally, thus ascertaining the truth or falsity of our theories. Without this assumption, indeed, the whole concept of a fact becomes elusive, perhaps even incoherent. Significantly, the root of the word is the Latin factio, a making or a doing, hinting perhaps at a former ambiguity between existence and perception, being and doing, what is and what is made. Perhaps facts, like artifacts and manufactures, are made by us. The universe out there is in principle unconnected to one or another observer, hence the replicability of scientific experiment. If you and I query the universe with an identical experiment, we arrive at an identical result. So blinded are we by our ontology that we see this not as an assumption, but a logical necessity. We can hardly imagine a cogent system of thought that doesn't embody objectivity. Neither can we imagine a system of thought that dispenses with determinism, which encodes the modern notion of causality. These we see as basic principles of logic, not the conditional cultural assumptions that they are. The unfortunate fact that the whole of 20th century physics invalidates precisely these principles of objectivity and determinism has not yet sunk into our intuitions. The classical Newtonian worldview has been obsolete for 100 years, but we still have not absorbed the revolutionary implications of quantum mechanics that replaced it. Amazingly, 80 years after its mathematical formalization, quantum mechanics defies interpretation. Today, some 5 or 6 major interpretations of quantum theory, along with countless variations, boast adherence not just among amateur philosophers and New Age seekers, but among mainstream academic physicists, many of whom eschew interpretation altogether and use the mathematics of the theory in apparent disregard of its ontological significance. Either they cannot agree on the interpretation of the theory, or they have given up even trying, because no interpretation is compatible with our fundamental cultural assumptions about the nature of reality. The worldview of classical science I describe in this chapter, obsolete though it may be, still informs the dominant beliefs and institutions of our culture. Science is a vast and elaborate articulation of the defining myth of our civilization, that we are discrete and separate selves, living in an objective universe of others. Science presupposes and embodies and reinforces that myth, blinding us to other ways of thinking, living, and being. Both justifications for the religion of science engender the same kind of limitation. The power of technology confirms with circular logic the practical truth of our science in precisely those areas in which it applies, yet it limits us to those areas. Meanwhile, the scientific method by its very nature excludes whole classes of possible phenomena from ever being established. It is constitutionally incapable of apprehending phenomena that are not objective or deterministic. Believing in the scientific method as the best way yet discovered for winnowing the truth from lies and delusion, we therefore conclude that such phenomena don't really exist. They are lies, delusions, hoaxes, superstitions. Our ontology and method is fundamentally unable to countenance such possibilities as, "The unicorn was there for me and not for you," except by explaining them away along the lines of, "It was there, but you didn't see it." Existence, being there, is assumed to have an absolute, objective reality, independent of whether or not anyone observes it. More precisely, we naively associate existence with some event in an absolute Cartesian coordinate system. If the unicorn was at point X, Y, and Z at time T, then it exists. Go ahead, try it. Close your eyes and visualize something, say a fork, merely existing. Do you see a disembodied fork floating alone in space? Separation is woven into our conception of being. Existence happens in isolation, not in relationship. To be is to occupy a discrete point in space and time. That would be fine if the universe were really like that. However, ancient ways of thinking and 20th century physics both agree that it is not. The absolute Cartesian universe is at best an approximation, a mathematical tool useful for solving a very narrow range of problems. Yet we have attempted to force the whole of reality into its mold. In elevating the scientific method to a defining test for truth, we implicitly decree by fiat the very assumptions upon which it rests. The scientific method relies for its supracultural validity on principles that are themselves among its own assumptions. The logic of its justification is circular. A parallel would be an Aborigine insisting, "Okay, let's settle this question of whether scientific experiment or dreaming is the way to true knowledge once and for all. Let's settle it by entering the dream time and asking the ancestors." It's hard to imagine, but the principal assumptions of objectivity and determinism that lie at the foundation of the scientific method are by no means shared by all the world's traditions of thought. A non-objective, non-deterministic, yet coherent system of thought is possible. It is more than possible. It is necessary, given the impending collapse of the world of the discrete and separate self that we have wrought. It is also necessary in the light of the new scientific revolution of the last 100 years. Our ways of thinking and being are not working anymore. Science is the intensification of trends of self-conception going back thousands of years. Objectivity and determinism reflect profoundly the way we understand ourselves in relation to the world, infiltrating at the deepest levels of our thought, language, and reason. Witness the above phrase, quote, "If the universe were really like that," close quote. What is this really? It means something like, not just in the opinion of some, but in actual fact. And what is this actual fact? Non-objective thinking is exceedingly difficult to communicate when the assumption of objectivity is built into the language of that communication. Again, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. Objectivity and determinism are woven into our very self-definition. That is why the new sciences of the 20th century have been so difficult to integrate into our general understanding of the universe. That is why the findings of quantum mechanics seem so counterintuitive, so weird. We sense ourselves as discrete beings, separate from the universe around us. Accordingly, the scientific method is unable to handle phenomenon of which the experimenter is an inseparable aspect. Suppose something like telepathy works if and only if the experimenter genuinely believes it will. If this is the case, telepathy is inherently beyond the reach of the scientific method because the experiment is not freely replicable. A skeptical experimenter cannot confirm it by precisely replicating the initial conditions, because the initial conditions bring different results for different experimenters. This failure of determinism, identical initial conditions bringing different results, can only be resolved by recognizing the experimenter as part of those conditions, thereby invalidating the principle of objectivity. I am not advocating the abolition of the scientific method. I am simply illuminating its inherent limitations as well as the type of knowledge it is constitutionally able to produce. The scientific method has a place, a very important place, in the new science that will emerge as our society evolves. At its heart, the scientific method rests upon a beautiful impulse, an ideal of humility and intellectual non-attachment that would serve any system of belief in good stead. In Chapter 6, I will describe a different approach to experimental science, a play with nature and not a Baconian interrogation, that preserves the ideal of humility without objectivity's alienation. Generally speaking, the scientific method fails to deliver certainty whenever the very act of formulating and testing a theory about a supposed reality out there creates or alters that reality. A model for understanding how objectivity in science can fail is journalism, which clearly illustrates the necessary codependence of observer and reality. People behave differently when they know a journalist is present. Moreover, by reporting an event, we change its significance, to the point where some events are newsworthy only because there are journalists present. Further compromising objectivity is the inevitable projection of a news organization's values and priorities onto its criteria for newsworthiness. Nonetheless, journalists still pretend to an objectivity which is not only an impossible ideal, but even worse, an incoherent concept and a dangerous trap. Yet objectivity remains a near universal standard of intellectual probity in our culture. The ideal of the detached scientist eliminating a personal prejudice in a quest for pure objective truth projects onto other fields like journalism, law, and even personal life, in which a rational decision, quote-unquote, is one made free from emotional attachment. A little reflection reveals that such objectivity is impossible. Moreover, its blind pursuit limits what we can possibly apprehend and erects a dispiriting wall of separation between ourselves and the universe. Not only scientific objectivity, but reason itself expresses and reinforces our gradual abstraction from nature. As David Bohm explains, reason is essentially the application of an abstracted relationship onto something new. We observe the relationship between A and B and say that the relationship between C and D will be like that too. For example, All humans die. I am a human, therefore I will die. A is to B, and C is to D. Or A colon B is equivalent to C colon D. That is a ratio. It is rational. Reason is the recognition and application of abstracted regularities. The criticism of professional skeptics on such forums as Reason.com that New Age spirituality and other denials of objectivity-based science are irrational has merit. Reason, as they understand it, is contingent upon and not prior to the assumption of an objective reality from which we can abstract. If this assumption is untrue, then other forms of cognition are valid and reason fraught with peril. The mathematical connotations of the word rational, containing as it does the word ratio, suggest as well that rational thought embodies the rigor and certainty of mathematics. And unlike a mere number, which originally at least is associated with concrete objects and therefore, as in science, attached to units, a ratio cancels out units to arrive at a pure abstraction, disconnected from any specific experience. This contributes to our elevation of reason to a supernatural province abstracted from concrete reality, abstracted, that is, from nature. As the faculty of reason is unique to human beings, we consider it proof of our ascent above nature. And the more we rely on reason, the farther above nature we ascend. Hence the dream of the perfectly rational society as the pinnacle of human development. Science and indeed reason itself are based on the discovery of regularities in nature. The possibility that we are not observing but rather creating these regularities through our beliefs presents a profound challenge to the very validity of science as we know it, implying that we are merely observing our own reflection. Beyond these two opposed possibilities lies a third, dialectic possibility of mutual co-creation of belief and reality, that affirms the fundamental non-separation of subject and object. The deep presumption underlying the scientific method and the whole edifice of scientific reason is that there is a reality out there, independent of me, waiting to be discovered. It is the exact counterpart of our foundational cultural assumption of the separate self in a world of discrete others. It is yet another flavor of the basic dualism of subject and object. This is the cultural assumption that grew through the ascent of humanity, whose origins I explored in the previous chapter, which motivated technology and was in turn motivated by technology in a self-reinforcing loop. Science has merely taken it to its logical extreme, to its fulfillment. Science, therefore, is not prior to our understanding of self and universe. It is an outgrowth of this understanding. Science is an ideology. Like other cultures before us, we have created a mythology, a constellation of stories to explain the way of the world. It includes the forces of nature, the forces of human nature, the story of our origins, and an account of our role and function in the universe. Like all of those cultures, our mythology is not wholly fabricated, but a window on the truth, painted, however, with the distorting lens of our culture's prejudices. Science is this mythology's consummation. The study of science, therefore, reveals as much about ourselves as it does about the world. This chapter explores the scientific life, personal and collective, that we have made for ourselves. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. My Personal Age of Reason. Rational linear proof is what the mind demands. The heart's way begins when one lays one's head on a person's chest and drifts into the answer. Coleman Barks. What is it to be scientific? What does that word mean in the context of day-to-day life? Since the 17th century, the man of reason has been elevated above all others, and reason assigned the highest status among all forms of cognition. Reason is, after all, the unique province of humankind, distinguishing us from the animals, elevating us past our biological heritage of instinct and emotion. To be a creature of reason, then, is to be more ascended. It is to be more a man and less an animal. I use the word man for human advisedly here, because cultural prejudice has long held reason to be a distinguishing quality of the male sex. Men were supposed to be more rational, women more emotional and more intuitive. Women were thought closer to their biology, more subject to the periodic fluctuations of hormones. Tied up in our elevation of reason, then, is the elevation of the male sex above the female. Reason is a male-associated trait, not because men are more capable of it, but because they apply it more broadly. Generally speaking, the men of our culture deploy reason in more situations than women, even and especially in situations in which reason is inappropriate. If we see reason as a hallmark of separation, then the male predilection for reason is evidence for the more extreme separation of the male sex. Women, and more generally the feminine, including the inner feminine of both sexes, offer us men a way to reconnect with the biology, emotion, and intuition that reason has separated us from. Like the mythological Greek hero Theseus, we wander in a labyrinth of rationality and ego in which lurks a monster that can devour us. The Minotaur is a beast with a human head, the face of reason atop the drives of biology. To it we sacrifice, as did the Athenians, the best and brightest of our youth. Once inside the labyrinth, the only way out is by following the lifeline that woman alone offers. I'm intimately familiar with the labyrinth of rationality because I lived in it for many years. Applying logic first to any situation, suppressing emotion, and deploying reason, I thought myself more cognitively evolved, more intelligent than most other people, a higher sort of man, more scientific, more rational, in a word, better. I acted from the mind, which was higher, rather than the emotions, which were lower. In applying reason to my own life, I echoed the ideals of Enlightenment philosophers who thought that a new age of reason would usher in a perfect society. Reason was to be an omnipotent tool that would solve all the world's problems. You can probably imagine some of the calamities that befell me as I pursued my personal age of reason. Numbing down my emotions, I could make decisions only by comparing one list of reasons, the pros, to another, the cons. I tried very hard to figure things out, but either way, my decisions lacked the certitude that accompanies a heart-based choice. Doubt plagued me, and I was unable to follow through on any decision wholeheartedly. I became paralyzed with indecision before and doubt after any decision I made. To compensate for the numbness, I would create vast, elaborate networks of reasons and justifications to bolster my decisions, but no matter how hard I tried, I felt hopelessly adrift. Much later, I understood that all my reasons were actually rationalizations for choices already made, non-rationally, based on something unconscious and unfelt. To bring to light the hidden determinants of my choices became an urgent priority. If not for reasons, then why do I do the things that I do? Notice the parallels between this and our own collective age of reason. For all our clever elaborations, are we too not adrift in a sea of impotent analysis and explanation, propelled headlong toward calamity by forces we're only dimly aware of? Does not our collective history repeat itself, just as I helplessly recreated the same patterns in my life again and again? Do we not still look to reason, embodied in science, to save us, just as I tried repeatedly to figure out a solution to my problems? Whether on a personal or planetary level, the same conceit rules. If we only try hard enough, we can figure out everything and live happily ever after. When did I finally abandon my personal version of the scientific program? Only when a series of crises ripped apart the fabric of my life in a way that made it abundantly clear that the program of management and control was doomed. Look at the world around us. Is there any doubt that collectively we too are approaching such a moment? I am not advocating the abolition of reason. As with the scientific method, reason has its proper place. Operating within their proper spheres, both are tools for the creation of wonders. The problem comes when they exceed their proper bounds, as they did in my own life, and seek to bring the whole of reality under their sway. The consequences of this happening are escalating damage and depletion of the social and/or physical environment. In the personal example, other people get hurt. In the collective example, it is whole cultures, ecosystems, and the planet itself. Eventually, because the self-other distinction is not fundamentally valid, the damage and depletion circles back to affect the self, inevitably. Managing, fixing, and controlling these consequences can only work temporarily and at an escalating price, because it is in fact the mindset of separation behind these responses that caused the damage in the first place. The anthroposophical physician Tom Cowan offers an interesting metaphor for this process, drawing on the medieval alchemical tradition. The alchemists understood human beings as consisting of three parts: the head, the thoracic region of the heart and lungs, and the viscera. The head, symbolized by silver, is cool, static, and reflective. The heart, symbolized by gold, warm and rhythmic. The viscera, symbolized by sulfur, hot and transformative. In this philosophy, the faculty of knowledge resides not in the head, but in the heart. The heart is for knowing, and the head for reflection. Cowan explains the consequences of the head function invading the rest of the body. Its stillness manifests as concrescences and sclerosis, such as stones in the organs, plaques in the heart and arteries, and tumors all over. Is it mere coincidence that the technological artifacts of the Age of Reason are also predominantly hard? Pavement, buildings, metal and plastic, all are designed to resist the rhythms and transformative processes of nature. Looking down from an airplane, the burgeoning suburbs look like metastasizing tumors radiating out from the urban hubs. The earth's softness turned hard. In the personal story I have related, and in the whole culture of science, the head has usurped the heart's function as the organ of knowing. We intuit this when we associate the alchemical head quality of coolness with the exercise of reason. Coldly rational, we say, or cool-headed. The head is meant to reflect, to consider, to explore, but it is the heart that is meant to know and therefore to choose. The idea of choice not compelled by reasons runs counter to a fundamental principle of classical physics, determinism. A mass in a Newtonian system has no choice. Its motion forever into the future is wholly determined by the forces acting upon it. When we see ourselves in the same way, science's promise of control comes at an enormous price, an equivalent feeling of helplessness. We, like a Newtonian mass, are wholly determined by the totality of the forces acting upon us. The universe of classical science is a universe of force. While the achievements of the scientific revolution gave explicit form to this principle, it actually goes back much farther, back into the very origins of separation. It harks back to the ancient farmer, applying force to keep the land from reverting to its wild state. It harks back to the builder societies, replacing natural forms with human creations through human effort. The conquest of nature and human nature requires, like all military endeavors, force. The history of technology is a history of humanity putting greater and greater energies at its disposal, graduating from human power to animal to water and wind, to steam to oil and gas and electricity to nuclear power. And since energy in physics is nothing but force integrated over a distance, the ascent of humanity amounts to the exercise of more and more force. It is the bringing of force under human control. The fulfillment of human destiny, then, would be the harnessing of all the forces of nature to bring them wholly into the human realm. Forces in physics are the counterpart of reasons in our own lives. Just as we attempt to understand events by looking into the reasons that caused them to happen, so also do we understand the behavior of a physical system by adding up all the forces acting upon it. My personal age of reason had all the hallmarks of the classical scientific worldview. Steeped in the ideology of science, any other approach to knowledge seems nonsensical. It is ironic, indeed, that my own attempt to live a scientific life governed by reason, which was motivated by a desire for control and certainty, generated instead crisis and uncertainty. The same has happened globally. The scientific method really comes down to, let's check and make sure. Yet we are increasingly unsure, paralyzed by the same doubt I experienced in my own life. The welter of opposing voices in my head mirrors the bitterly conflicting interests of modern politics and other institutions that thwart any purposeful transformation. They leave us helpless, trundling forward under the momentum of the past, buffeted by forces beyond our control. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein.
I was driving down some big highway, somewhere going someplace, through a town that looked just like the last. I passed a billboard that said, if I buy that shit I'd feel better. I just pulled off to fill up the gas. In the truck stop TV showed the president's face, with the stars and stripes waving in back. He said, my fellow Americans, I can assure you today, peace and freedom is why we attacked. And it's days like these I find myself growing cold, trying to hold the rage that I feel. In this country of hearts that are freezing like ice, in this nation asleep at the wheel, I feel like I'm clear cut. I feel like my rivers have run dry, and I'm raw beneath the open sky and the rain. When it carry me away in a land. see people who know something is terribly wrong. They say there's nothing anyone can do about it now. It's been going on for way too long. And all we can do is just learn how to cope, try to make it through another year. Yeah, who needs dictatorship or martial law when you got TV, dependence, and fear? Meanwhile, the kings and queens in their castles are trying to turn everything they touch into gold. And even the devastation they leave in their wake is a new market to be bought and then sold. I feel like I'm clear cut. I feel like my rivers have run dry. And I'm raw beneath the open sky and the rain. When it comes, will carry me away in a landslide. This broken world was all I knew, and all I heard was sorrow's cry. What would I know of anger and hope, or for what would be worthy to die? But I have seen forests as old as riverbeds, seen trees that rise up to the dawn. And I have known love that rises above the despair that this cruel world brings on. I've seen beauty in the eyes of another. I've heard music you would not believe. And the source of my pain is the source of my hope in a vision of what this world could be. Thank you.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Masters of the Universe. Scientific thought is essentially power thought. The sort of thought that is to say whose purpose, conscious or unconscious, is to give power to its possessor. Bertrand Russell. At its purest, the purpose of science is to better understand the world, or we could say it is to bring new worlds into the human domain of understanding. Science begins as an exploration of the unknown, and later becomes a conquest that subjugates that unknown to human purposes. It is thus highly significant that the scientific revolution coincided so closely in time with the European age of exploration. In both, we see the same missionary zeal, the same sense of a new world of possibility, the same ideological roots, and the same tragic consequences. The age of exploration led to the age of imperialism, both geopolitical and scientific. The urge to discover new lands was never innocent of the power motive. The sense of mission that drove the Europeans to civilize and colonize the world also infuses science. To civilize, to make tame, to bring order to colonize, to make subservient, to administer as a source of raw materials. Science colonizes the world for technology, finding ways to put materials to use, harnessing the forces of nature. Each new world that science discovered, the microscopic and the celestial, the electromagnetic and the chemical, was first explored and then exploited as a new dominion. Both campaigns of conquest, the scientific and the terrestrial, are expressions of the same aspiration, to make the world ours. Starting about 500 years ago, scientists and explorers issued forth from the old world into a new. One frontier after another succumbed. The heavens, the seas, the poles, the archaeological past, Everest, the cell, the genes, outer space, the atom. Concurrent with the expansion of the territory of civilization, the human realm broadened with each scientific conquest, and the realm of the mysterious, the wild, shrank. By the end of the 19th century, both conquests seemed nearly complete. Only a few scattered hunter-gatherer tribes remained in the Earth's remotest regions, and only a free recondite phenomena, it seemed, still eluded the onward march of science. The exhilarating promise of the new worlds sparked an optimism and a zeal that was to last for several centuries. Some vestige of it remains today in persistent hopes that nanotechnology or genetic engineering will bring the same easy riches or even the fountain of youth once sought in the terrestrial new world. But as I observed in Chapter 1, confidence in this promise is wearing thin.